Do you remember years ago how much we looked forward to those wonderful Christmas radio programs that had become as much of a tradition as the Christmas tree itself? Well, you're about to have that experience again as we turn back the clock. Close your eyes and listen. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Dick Bertel. From the rare collection of radio historian Ed Corcoran of Wapping, Connecticut, you'll hear once again the voices of Harold Peary as the Great Gildersleeve, John McCormick. You'll relive Christmas during the dark days of World War II with the voice of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, the music of Glenn Miller, the laughter of Bob Hope, and the songs of Dinah Shore. Once again, we'll join One Man's Family on Christmas Eve, and we'll laugh with Fred Allen and his immortal Christmas classic, Santa Claus Goes on Strike, all in a special presentation for Christmas.
Society for Savings, the bank with your future in mind, is pleased to present the first half hour of this special Christmas program, Echoes of Christmas Past.
And now let's meet the man with over 1,200 hours of radio memories on tape, Mr. Ed Corcoran. Well, Ed, this is our second Christmas get-together in what seems to be an annual radio program. Do you find more and more interest is developing in these old-time radio shows?
Dick, every week it seems to be getting more and more that way. I've had a number of people call me who have heard me on the station, and I would say the number of collectors has practically doubled since last year when we did this show.
And where are your sources of supply coming from?
Well, we are getting a lot from some of the radio stations themselves. People are finding out that these recordings are going out of existence, and they're going to the stations, and many times they're glad to get rid of them. They're taking up space, and rather than discard them, they pick them up. One fellow in New York, I believe, has picked up several thousand, and there's a fellow on the West Coast who has 10,000 radio transcriptions. Can you imagine 10,000 of these things? That'd take up all of your basement and a good deal more, I'm sure.
I'm sure it would. Well, you know, radio played an important part in our lives in the 30s and 40s when, as I think we've pointed out before, we couldn't afford much else in the way of entertainment, but especially so at Christmas time. Do you recall looking forward to those wonderful annual Christmas shows?
Yes, certainly I did, Dick, because I was more than just an average radio fan. I was, devoted to the art, and Christmas was especially rewarding. There were at least a dozen different programs that were done, and we'll do some of them tonight, of course. And I think that all children go through this. I think if you ask your own children 10 years from now what they remember about Christmas, undoubtedly The Wizard of Oz will be remembered, and perhaps also the Amahl and Night Visitor and some of the other things that are done on television. So I think the present generation is going through the same type of thing. They'll remember these things, but while I remember the things that were done on radio.
Well, of course, there were some very great radio programs, and we're going to hear some of them tonight. As a matter of fact, we're going to run the gamut, as it were, from the 20s through the late 40s. But we're going to start out with a young man. He was a young man then, certainly, in the 40s, Harold Peary, who developed a character on the Fibber McGee and Molly radio program called The Great Gildersleeve. Ed, do you remember The Great Gildersleeve?
Very much so. It was the one of several characters who appeared on the program who later went on to do other things, but probably the most famous. And he was on for a number of years, and then he finally got his own program. And also it was on television for a short time as well. So it had a very long life, I'd say probably 10 or 12 years that this particular program or this character was heard on radio.
Well, The Great Gildersleeve would depart from his regular format at least for 1 week during the Christmas season to do a delightful story that has charmed children and adults since time began, I guess. I wonder if you'd tell us about this special show.
Well, as I recall, the one he did, he liked especially was Cinderella. This appeals, as you said, to people of all ages, and this was done, I think, very professionally because he had his own writers actually do the script for him. I think it was John Whedon and Sam Moore, and the musical score was composed by Robert Emmett Dolan, who is quite well known in musical circles. So this was a very fine production, and it was one that was worthwhile looking forward to each year.
Let's listen once again, then, to a portion of the broadcast of The Great Gildersleeve, portrayed by Harold Peary, doing Cinderella.
Isn't that pretty? There's a story that goes with that. and the story is just as pretty. Once there was a man who married an angel. She wasn't really an angel, but she was so sweet and kind and good, she seemed like one to him. In fact, she was too good for this earth, and soon she died, leaving him with a little daughter, who in every way was just like her mother, sweet and kind and good, and pretty too. But the poor man was very lonely, and in time he married another wife. You couldn't blame him for trying again. He had done so well the first time. But this wife turned out to be very ordinary. Not just ordinary, but mean and bossy and stuck up. She had two daughters of her own, and they were stuck up too. And homely? Oh, brother. I don't know what they were so stuck up about. Well, it wasn't so hard on the father. He managed to spend a good deal of his time down cellar and didn't know half of what went on. But his poor little daughter, the new wife was jealous of her. She made her do all the nastiest work in the house and gave her only ragged clothes to wear so she wouldn't look so pretty. When company came to call, she would trot out her own two girls and have them recite little pieces. But the pretty one she kept hidden in the kitchen. The only place she was allowed to sit was in a corner of the fireplace among the ashes and cinders. People called the poor girl Cinderella, but her stepmother just addressed her as, "Hey, you!" "Oh, my goodness! Oh, my goodness! 12 o'clock!" She turned and ran across the slippery dance floor, down the long halls, with the prince after her. "Wait! Wait!" But she didn't wait. She dashed out the door and down the steps. Halfway down, one of her glass slippers flew off. The prince stopped to pick it up, and that was the last he saw of her. When he reached the curb where her coat should have been, all he found was a battered old pumpkin and some mice skittering down the gutter. Days passed, and still no sign. The prince decided he would advertise, so he rigged up a contest. He announced that he would personally marry any girl whose foot would fit the glass slipper, and he sent a man around from house to house with a free offer to try it on. The prince well knew there was only one foot in the entire kingdom, tiny and delicate enough to fit that little slipper. But no one else knew that, and every woman under 50 had a go at it, even Cinderella's sisters. They tugged and they squeezed. Oof! Zeep! But it was no use. Finally, they had to give up. Then Cinderella said shyly, "Let me try." "Oh, for heaven's sake," said the sisters. But the man with the slipper insisted that the offer was open to all. He had her sit down. She put out her dainty foot, and he tried the slipper. And behold, it fitted as if it had been made for her, which it had. Well, sir, you could have knocked her sisters over with a feather. And if I had been there, I would have done it. They simply couldn't believe their eyes. But just so there might be no mistake, the fairy godmother suddenly appeared from nowhere and touched Cinderella with her magic wand. And in a twinkling, she was revealed as the beautiful princess. But when the prince heard she was found, he was so happy he declared this an ideal occasion for a grand ball, to be followed immediately by another announcing their engagement, and one after that celebrating their marriage. Some say the festivities lasted altogether 7 days, and you may be sure there was plenty of dancing.
Well, that voice certainly brings back pleasant memories. The Great Gildersleeve, portrayed by Harold Perry, the first of our Christmas specials for this year's show.
Society for Savings, the bank with your future in mind, is presenting this first half of Echoes of Christmas Past. Once again, here is Dick Bertel.
We turn now to a period in radio's development which may not be recalled as one of the warmest, but certainly it was the most dramatic, the period of World War II. This was the first time the American people were made aware of a war's devastation. They were actually a part of that war, weren't they?
Yes, for the first time, because radio was quite in its infancy back in World War I, but in World War II, there were actual broadcasts made at Omaha Beach and some of the other famous battlegrounds, and the communication between what was happening at the theater of operations and the people at home was only a matter of minutes, or sometimes it was live from what was happening there. It was broadcast back to the States, so we were very close to it at that time. There was very little gap between the events themselves and the reporting of these via radio to the public.
Well, narrowing our field down to the role that radio played during World War II at Christmas time, we must go back to the year 1939. And what was the situation regarding the background of this broadcast?
Well, of course, in World War II, London and other parts of England were bombed quite heavily, and it was found that moving the children into the country wasn't always the answer. They were still not safe from the enemy. So many of them were brought over to this country and were given foster homes for the duration by public-spirited citizens, I would say. And this particular Christmas, it was arranged that the children could talk to their parents, who some of them haven't seen in almost a year. And this was so poignant that it was recorded, and it's a part of radio history, this particular little excerpt we're going to hear.
Hello, Mom.
Hello, Dad. How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you? I hope you're having a merry Christmas.
This is Violet.
Yes.
Come on, don't be
silly now. Just a moment. Mrs. Dollop, just a moment. We'll have Violet for you in just a minute. Here's Ronnie. Here's Ronnie, who wants to add a word, and then we'll come back to Violet.
Hi, Mom.
Hello, Dad. How are you?
I'm going to cry.
That is rather moving to hear those voices and emotions captured as they were on radio back in 1939. Well, now we advance 2 years. This is Christmas Eve, 1941, perhaps one of the darkest in American history. We were now immersed in World War II on two fighting fronts, and the nation was looking for assurance from its president.
Yes, I was quite young at the time myself, and I do feel that as a youngster, we looked up to President Roosevelt. You know, he was really a leader. He wouldn't have been elected four times if he wasn't, and his words did carry a lot of conviction, and it was almost like a father image. You know, if things went wrong, you listen to what he had to say, and Pearl Harbor had only preceded this broadcast by a few weeks, so we haven't got over the shock of being in the war yet, and everybody was listening to hear what he was going to say, you know, how he was going to set the tone of a nation at war. And this excerpt from the address he gave in Christmas 1941, I think more than anything else we could play, sets the spirit of World War II.
Fellow workers for freedom, there are many men and women in America, sincere and faithful men and women, who are asking themselves this Christmas, how can we light our tree? How can we give our gifts? How can we meet and worship with love and with uplifted spirit and heart in a world at war, a world of fighting and suffering and death?
Well, of course, when we look at World War II in that era, we must think of the big bands, and the one that comes to mind immediately, as far as I'm concerned, and just about everybody else, I guess, is Glenn Miller. And it was not long after war broke out that Glenn Miller and the entire Glenn Miller Band joined the Army, didn't they? The Air Force.
Oh, actually, the Army, because the Air Force was still the Air Corps as part of the Army at that time, and he went in as a captain, and he did take, they say, most of his band with him. But prior to that, he did tour the country at a lot of the installations. I think that was probably what got him interested in the service, because he had such a great effect on the morale of the trainees at that time in the various camps throughout the United States that they felt it was a good idea to have him in and do this full time, because it had such a great impact on the morale of the troops. The one we're going to hear was a broadcast done in San Diego, which is still a Navy or Marine town today. I was out there not too long ago, and it's literally a government installation, the whole town, really. They have miles and miles of docks and many, many soldiers and sailors and Marines that are there full time. So, but during World War II, probably every second person in San Diego was a service personnel in the service.
And the broadcast that you're about to hear, of course, was being beamed primarily to those servicemen in San Diego back in 1942. The music of Glenn Miller and the orchestra.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the first of this week's Moonlight Serenades, coming to you from the Pacific Square here in San Diego. Paula and the Modern Air start serenading with Perfidia.
We'll continue with Christmas during World War II right after this message from Lou Palmer.
Take the crisp cold of a December night, add two generous parts of snow, stir in air so clear it tingles. Into a generous heart, mix the wonder of a little girl, the sparkle of a little boy's glance, the love of parents, and set gently before the chimney side. Add the lightest touch of reindeer's hooves, a sprig of holly, a scent of fir. Set the mixture to rise in the warmth of a dream of goodwill to men. Bake in an oven of kindness and tolerance It will be ready to serve when it bubbles with warmth and good feeling. Bedeck with the light of a star set in the east. Garnish with shining balls of gold, silver, and red. Serve to the tune of an ancient carol in the middle of the family table. This recipe is sufficient for all the men and women you will ever meet.
Well, Bob Hope, of course, has been associated with our fighting men entertaining our American troops since the beginning of World War II. Of course, he still does it today. But this all began at the outbreak of war, and Bob Hope was one of the brightest spots, I guess, in a serviceman's life, wasn't he?
Yeah, I would say just about everybody saw him at one time or another. He really circled the globe. He did time in both the Pacific and the European theaters, and when he wasn't making pictures, he was actually doing this work. And many of his broadcasts originated from Army camps. He had a weekly show with Jerry Colonna and some of the other members of the cast. Vera Veg, you remember her?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he found that a GI audience is a very appreciative audience. These fellows are cooped up. They're leading a rather rigorous life, and he seemed to be able to turn them on. That's not an expression we used in those days, but that really was what happened. But he could liven up any audience, even men in the hospital, with all their troubles, would laugh when Bob Hope came around.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Bob broadcasting from Camp Roberts Hope, telling you to make your teeth nice and white with Pepsodent, and when you listen to the president speak, you'll always have a good map to look at. It's a nice opening line, piecework. Well, here I am at Camp Roberts. Camp Roberts is just about in Central California. Central California, this is where the fog from San Francisco comes down to sneer at the fog from Los Angeles. Oh, you know, huh? I want to tell you, I'm enjoying it here. I got a lovely reception. You know how they give important people an escort of two officers riding ahead on motorcycles? Well, for me, they had a campfire girl and a pogo stick. And gosh, I had a nice trip up here. You've seen those beautiful streamlined trains. Well, while we were riding up here, six of them passed our bus.
Yes, sir, men of the Coast Guard, that wraps it up for now. It's been great visiting all you fellas. You know, Coast Guard has always meant tough men and tough little cutters who tackle the oceans on stormy nights to rescue shipwrecked sailors, who bust up icebergs in our shipping lanes and keep friendly beacons burning in lighthouses from New England to the Golden Gate. Always a great name from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Today, it's a great name from Italy to the Marshall Islands. For it's the Coast Guard that races up to those beachheads to deliver the fighting Marines, and the Coast Guard that has kept Uncle Sam's harbors free of major catastrophe the past 2 years, guarding harbors and vessels against accident and sabotage to set an amazing wartime record of port security and speed shipping on its way to the battlefronts. And it's the Coast Guard that's in there beside the tankers and troop ships, tossing ash cans in the U-boats and taking on anything the enemy puts in their way. You know, they got a little motto in the Coast Guard, Semper Paratus, always ready. And mister, whenever there's a tough job to do, you'll find the Coast Guard always ready and willing and able to do it. Thanks, fellas. So long, boys.
Now, that theme song brings back some pleasant memories. Well, now we're going to turn to a personal side of World War II. It's Christmas 1944. Where do we find Ed Corcoran?
Well, at that time it was somewhere in France. Actually, it was in the Reims area. And we had a USO show that came over about that time with Dinah Shore, who was very young herself in that era. I guess she was probably around 20, 21. And the reason it was personal is because one of the fellows that I was with, not at this particular time, but earlier in my career, was inducted the same day at the same draft board as her husband, George Montgomery, which was out in Seattle. This was, I believe, in March or April of 1943, and not many people even knew she was married. So when I talked to her, I mentioned this, and she was quite excited about it, and she did sign the autograph on a 10-franc note, which I still have somewhere in my collection at home. But she was very gracious, and she sang until her voice gave out. She just couldn't sing another note. She just, at any request, she would play it. And she had a very good group with her that could they could play anything you wanted, you know, Christmas carols or any of these popular songs at that time, any of the older songs. They just were, there's nothing she, no request she couldn't do for you.
Well, let's go back then to Christmas 1944 in Reims, France, for this performance by Dinah Shore.
A merry Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. From now on, our troubles will be miles away. Once again, as in olden days, happy golden days of yore. Dear to us, gather near to us once more. Through the years, we all will be together if the fates allow. Hang a shining star upon the highest bough.
This first portion of Echoes of Christmas Past has been brought to you by Society for Savings, the bank with your future in mind. This is WTIC in Hartford. Now back to Dick Bertel.
Let's turn now to the warm memories of Christmas on radio again with one of the most popular programs on the air, One Man's Family. Ed, who was the author of that show?
That was Carlton E. Morris, who is still very much with us and who I would consider to be maybe the most prolific writer of this century, because he wrote this program for some 27 years, and he did another programs, including I Love a Mystery, which is well-remembered, and many others, Adventures by Morse, I Love Adventure. So he wrote literally millions of words, and to write a continuing program for 27 years is quite an accomplishment in itself.
What was the basis of One Man's Family?
Well, it started, I guess it was mother and father, Barber, who he was a retired stockbroker, I guess just raised a family. Started with, I guess the first one was Paul, who was born back around 1890. As a matter of fact, I was figuring it out, Paul would be almost 70 years old, I think, if the program was still on the air, and Father Barber would be 94, which gives you some idea of the how much time has passed since this program started.
And did these people age as the program progressed?
Oh, yes. Jack started, I believe when the program went on the air, some of the children were already, were already teenagers or somewhere in that group. Paul was already grown up, because Paul was, I think he was in his 30s when the program started, but Jack and Cliff were still youngsters. And when the program went off the air, there were, I don't know how many great-grandchildren were in the family, quite a few. So it went through a whole generation, starting from teenagers, and their children had children, and that was about when the show left off. So it covered quite a wide time span, to say the least.
Well, what is the excerpt that we're going to hear today?
Well, it's very topical, Dick. It's when you think of Christmas, you think of family anyway, and if you're away from home, as I was in several Christmases, this was the next best thing to being there, because you really did feel like a part of the family if you heard the program any length of time. So if you couldn't share it with your own family, you had one man's family to do it with. And this excerpt is on Christmas Eve, oh, I'd say around 1947 or 48, when they were all around decorating the Christmas tree. And I think you'll hear a lot of familiar voices here. Just about all of the major family members are portrayed in this particular excerpt.
Oh, thank you, Mother. Also, there are spruce boughs decorating the stair railing, along with a great big Christmas stocking with each person's name on it.
Yeah, and they're full of nuts and candy and oranges and one for everybody.
Hank, you've been peeking.
Well, sure I have, Mom.
Well, that's my effort. Oh, yes, the decorations over the fireplace were in my department, too.
Well, I think we can give our sister Hazel a big hand.
How nice.
And now, Jack and Nicholas, who represent our electrical committee.
Well, first I'd like to say that anybody who steps on one of our light cords and causes a short circuit will have his favorite present taken off the tree and jumped up and down on by me personally.
Nicky, anything to add?
Oh, by all means.
Oh, Nicky loves to make a speech. You know that, Cliff.
Well, ignoring a bit of wifely impertinence, I wish to report that all the regular tree lights are in place as usual. And I'd like you to note at the tip of the tree a new Star of Bethlehem, which I was at great pains to obtain, and which I think will dominate the tree once the lights are turned on.
Well, what are we waiting for?
Sure, turn on the lights. Let's start getting the presents on.
We want presents. We want presents.
Oh,
we want presents.
Hey, quiet.
We
quiet.
Want
quiet.
Presents.
Quiet. Hush. There's one more committee. The Midnight Snack and Eats Committee. Headed up by Betty.
That's my wife you're talking about.
Yep, mother of three beautiful daughters.
Yep, all tucked in for the night, dreaming beautiful Christmas dreams.
Hey, I thought Aunt Betty was going to talk about food.
I am, Pinky. After all the presents have been brought out and put on the tree, there will be a buffet supper consisting of
30 sandwiches.
That's right, and a big
Waldorf salad.
You've been peeking.
Popcorn balls.
Hey, anyway, for drinks?
Coffee.
Sure, coffee, but
apple cider.
Right, and for dessert?
Fruitcake.
Hey, who's the committee around here anyway?
Okay, so much for committee reports. Now we're ready to turn on the tree lights.
Okay, hold it, everybody. All right, Nikki, turn out the living room lights.
Living room lights going out.
Dark. Give me your hand, Grandmother.
Yes, Margaret.
Okay, now on with the Christmas tree lights.
Christmas tree lights coming up. One, two, three. There.
Oh, look.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Oh, we've never had a prettier tree. Never.
Hey, why doesn't Cousin Jediah come on down? He's missing all the fun.
Yes, Henry, it's too bad. What's he doing?
Putting on his confounded Santa Claus suit.
Yeah, but what's taking him so long?
Henry, you'd better go up and see if he's all right and persuade him to come down.
Well, if he hasn't sense enough to come down,
I'll go up, Mom. I'll be right back down.
All right, okay now, everybody. The next step is for everybody to make himself comfortable in front of the fire for the ceremony of putting the presents on the tree. Yeah. Hey, somebody get the sleigh bell!
All that does bring back memories, the voices that were so familiar on One Man's Family. But now, Ed, you're going to take us back to the very beginnings of network radio broadcasting.
Yes, this was, I would say, the oldest property I have. This goes back to 1926, and as I said before we went on the air, this is even before my time. And this was when the NBC network was formed, and one of the first artists to appear nationwide was John McCormick, the very, very famous Irish tenor. And we are fortunate enough this evening to have a recording made in that time period in 1926, where he did Adeste Fidelis, which certainly would be a treat because many of our members of the audience, I'm sure, have never heard John McCormick. I know I've heard very few of his recordings, and they are quite rare these days.
Venite, venite in Bethlehem.
Well, now we come to the great highlight, I think, of our program, Echoes of Christmas Past, a broadcast which I look forward to year after year, and I know you did too, Ed, because we're both Fred Allen fans. An excerpt from his Christmas program called Santa Claus Goes on Strike. And I discovered in talking with people that most people don't remember this story. This surprised me. Can you account for that?
I really can't, unless they just weren't, maybe they're too young, but certainly anybody that was, around, say, in 1946 or prior would remember this, because Christmas wasn't Christmas without listening to Fred Allen do this particular excerpt. At least not to me, it wasn't.
Mm. Well, you know, in order to get permission to do this broadcast, we wrote to Bristol Myers Company, who sponsored Town Hall Tonight, which was the name of the Fred Allen program. And before we hear this particular excerpt and learn more about it, I'd like to read a portion of this letter to you. Dear Mr. Bertel, your letter of December 6th to Bristol Myers has been referred to this office for reply. Please be assured that you have our approval to present the Town Hall Tonight program, Santa Claus Goes on Strike. We certainly are in agreement with you that Fred Allen was a great entertainer. Certainly any relief that this form of humor could bring to an extremely somber world, I am sure, would be appreciated. Sincerely, James L. McWithey, Bristol Myers Company, New York. Our thanks to Bristol Myers for allowing us to present this excerpt. Before we hear it, Ed, I wonder if you'd tell us a bit about the people who were featured in it year after year.
Well, it's one of those things that the more you heard it, the more you liked it, like good music and perhaps seeing a good painting. But I think it's done with the greatest of taste. That's the thing about Fred Allen's work, that I never recall in all the years he was on the air he ever did anything which would ever be objectionable. You could bring your 5 or 6 or 7 year old child and listen to it, and you'd have nothing to be afraid about. But today, I'm not so sure that any of these programs today really can have those kind of standards. I don't think that they do for the most part. So, he was a great entertainer, and his monumental work was this particular excerpt, I would say.
Tonight, old Santa shows his claws in a modern tale called Santa Claus Goes on Strike, or Jingle Bells Shall Not Ring Tonight. Music, maestro.
A special announcement. Santa Claus will not ride this Christmas. In a terse bulletin issued from his North Pole igloo today, Santa says, quote, "I am on a sit-down strike. I refuse to ride this Christmas," unquote. Rumors flood the country.
A report from Miami, Florida says
200 families stop building chimneys on their cabanas. Do not expect Santa Claus.
At Rutland, Vermont, a little girl says,
"I wrote Santa Claus a letter airmail and got no answer. He ain't coming."
At Detroit, Michigan, a labor official says,
"Santa Claus better ride, or the Teamsters Union will pull out every reindeer from here to Nome."
Madison Square Garden, New York City, school children hold monster mass meeting. Tiny spokesman says,
"Santa Claus can't let us down. 200,000 American children have appointed me their spokesman. I'm off to see Santa Claus now. James, my jet scooter."
Come in, little boy. What are you doing way up here at the North Pole?
Ooh, is this Santa Claus igloo?
Yes, Sonny. I'm Mrs. Claus. Who are you?
I'm Buddy Jones.
Are you lost, Sonny?
No. I'm here to see why Santa Claus refuses to ride this year.
I'm glad you come, son. I've been arguing with the old thumpet all week, and he refuses to budge.
Where is Santa Claus now, Mrs. Claus?
He's in the next room there, tuning his reindeer bells and sulking.
Can I see Santa?
'Twon't do you no good, son, but I'll get him for you. Hey, Santa!
I ain't no use in coaxing, Ma. I ain't a goin'.
Come on out, stupid. You got company.
Who?
Jones, Santa Claus.
Well, don't mean nothing to me, small fry.
Is this awful rumor true, Santa Claus?
Yep, I ain't riding, son.
But this is Christmas Eve, Santa. Trees are lighted. Millions of trusting children have hung up their stockings. The world is waiting for you.
Well, the world can wait. I ain't a-riding.
But Santa...
No use, Nipper. He's stubborn.
No, I ain't not neither stubborn. Now, Mark, I'm just sick of being Santa Claus. The world don't appreciate nothing. Squabbling, striking, spying, warring.
But you can't quit, Santa. You must have a reason.
I got plenty of reasons, Sprout.
As spokesman for 200,000 kiddies, I demand a statement.
Well, what is it you want to know, Shaver?
Why won't you ride tonight, Santa Claus?
Well, sonny, I'll tell you. Come here, sit down here on my lap. Son, I've been Santa Clausing it ever since the world began. My intentions has been good, but my reward has been nothing but heartaches and misery. The first trouble I had was way back in ancient Rome. It was Christmas Eve in the court of Nero. The emperor was playing a violin concerto.
Sons, lackeys, you dare to give Nero the pheasant?
We want a hearty Estonian!
You rabble, scoff at my pizzicato.
Your music will never get Rome hottiest.
Yeah, and you know you're a Nicky. Get hottiest.
You dog. Be gone, hypocrite. Scram you.
Yeah. Ah, your father's toga.
Can't get hottiest, eh? Those swine.
I'll show them. Oh,
Watkins, what tumbles out of me chimney?
Man. Merry Christmas.
Who art thou, Lumpkin, the chimney sweep?
I'm Santa Claus, Nero, bearing Christmas gifts for your majesty.
Ultimus Nauseum, what is it? Another basket of figs from the Rome Kiwanis Club?
My gift is a trinket rare, Nero. So rare it hasn't even been invented yet. Here.
Gramercy, loud. What is this tiny golden box?
It's a cigarette lighter, Nero. Turn that little wheel.
Pot's blood, it flames.
Merry Christmas, Nero.
It flames. Rome has scoffed at Nero. Nero will have his revenge.
Hey, watch that lighter, Nero. You're setting fire to them draperies.
I can't make Rome hot with my music, eh? I'll make Rome hot another way. Revenge.
Look
revenge.
Out, Nero. Fire, fire. So you see, son, if it wasn't for Santa Claus, Rome wouldn't have burned that time.
Gosh, that was too bad, Santa.
You see, there I was trying to spread good cheer, and what did I get? The first hot foot in history.
But that was 2,000 years ago, Santa Claus. You shouldn't hold a grudge that long.
Well, Nero was just a prologue to my trouble, son. A few centuries later, I set out to bring a present to Napoleon and Josephine. I'll never forget that Christmas, son. Josephine was sitting on her cheesy davenport. Napoleon opened the door.
Ah, merci, ma petite.
Oh, nothing.
Oh, voilà. I am detour on the way to Waterloo, especially to say au revoir.
Oh, mon lover, mon nappy weapon.
Un moment, and your nappy is away. C'est la guerre.
I will be faithful.
Bien. If quelque man dare to pay court to my Josephine, I will kill him. Touché.
Your petite Josephine has no other boyfriend, nappy, you swear.
Eh bien, mon big beefy one.
I have a farewell present for you. I will it fetch a wit ici.
Eh bien, oh, mademoiselle from any place far. Who goes there? Who is coming through the fireplace?
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas.
Sacré bleu. You have come to woo my Josephine, gigolo wolf.
Hold on. Put down that truncheon.
Ah, man. Voilà qu'on chante. Un dix. Oh. Un dix. Un dix.
Oh.
Un dix.
Oh.
Un dix.
Oh.
Un dix.
Oh.
Un dix. Hey, bien riddance.
Voilà, your little Josephine returns, nappy.
Oh, with the mistletoe, you sly pussycat.
Oui. Oh, I forgot it is Christmas Eve. What can be keeping Santa Claus?
Mon Dieu. You are expecting the chap in the red suit?
Oui, nappy. Don't you think Santa Claus will come?
Not tonight, Josephine.
Yes. Yes, sonny. Napoleon, give me a concussion that Christmas. Running out of the castle, I fell in a moat. My ermine got wet and come to life. Her collar and one cuff got away.
But you can't stay mad at the world because years ago one crazy Frenchman mussed you up, Santa Claus.
Well, things has happened since, Sonny. Another Christmas, I got a raw deal in a suburb of England. It was called the American Colonies. I dropped in at the house of a jockey named Paul Revere. Well, the cottage had no chimney, so I peeked in at the window. Mrs. Revere was carving a Christmas turkey. Paul come a-gimping into the room.
Christmas dinner ready, Effie?
Yes, Paul. Pull up a chair.
No, no. Oop, no. Set my plate on the mantelpiece.
Can't you set down yet, Paul Revere? That ride was last April.
Through every Middlesex village and farm, ain't once around Central Park, Effie.
You ought to try and set down for Christmas, Paul. It'll be a nice present for your spy.
Who's that?
Might be a British spy, Paul.
Send me my gun, Effie. Who's there? Whig or Tory?
Merry Christmas, Paul Revere. It's me, Santa Claus.
So what?
I've got your Christmas present, Paul. It's a cushion stuffed with fuzz from Delaware peaches.
For me to sit on?
You bet.
Don't let him in.
I ain't sat down for 8 months, Effie. That buzz sounds mighty tempting.
Might be some enemy trick, Paul.
No, I'm Santa Claus. Honest Injun, Mrs. Revere. Open up.
I got my gun, Effie. I'll open the door a crack.
Merry
Paul, look at his suit.
A red coat. Take this.
Well, son, when I got back to my sleigh and sat down, I was mighty glad I still had that cushion full of Delaware peach fuzz. You see, son, the world's given old Santa plenty of trouble.
Gee, Santa, you've certainly had a lot of trouble.
Well, that's why my spirit's broken, sonny. You see, being Santa Claus is just a pain in one century after the other. I'm giving the world back to Rand and McNally. I'm sure.
On us kids, we'll have no toys.
Oh, Santa ain't a moving, son. This is one Christmas I'm going to enjoy in peace. What's that clock striking?
It's 12 o'clock.
Midnight, eh? Well,
it's Christmas Day, Santa Claus.
Don't mean nothing to me. I'm taking it easy. I'm staying right here.
Won't you change your mind, Santa?
I ain't getting kicked around again this Christmas.
Please, Santa Claus.
Oh, shucks. Hush your crying, son. Hey, Ma.
Yes, Santa?
Where's my mittens, my bag, my reindeer, my sleigh?
Santa, you ain't a-going.
Yep, I'm a-going, Ma.
Honest Santa Claus?
Yep, son, I changed my mind.
Oh, thank you, Santa.
Christmas ain't Christmas without Santa Claus. I'm giving the world one more chance.
Can I have a statement for all the kiddies, Santa?
You bet you can, sonny. Just say, it's Merry Christmas. Hi, old Dunder. Hi, old Blitzer.
Oh, and I enjoyed that. I really did. I remember almost every line of that program, and I haven't heard it in 20 years, except for you. I don't think that anybody else, I know that no one else has heard it in 20 years, because until we received permission from the sponsor, that program has not been on the air. Ed, it's been great getting together with you for these Echoes of Christmas Past. I hope you and your family are going to have a very, very Merry Christmas tomorrow, and I look forward to working with you again and hearing more of these excerpts.
Well, Dick, hope we can do it again next year. It was a great pleasure, and I hope that the people enjoyed it and made their Christmas a little bit better hearing some of these old shows we did for them today.
A Merry Christmas to you, and good night.
Good night, Dick.
Tonight, from the rare collection of radio historian Ed Corcoran, we have presented the voices of Harold Peary as the Great Gildersleeve, John McCormick, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, Glenn Miller, Bob Hope, Dinah Shore, the Barber Family, and Fred Allen. Echoes of Christmas Past was written for radio by Richard Bertelman. Special effects were by Bennett Zinkerman. Production coordinator was John Burchard. The program was edited by Bob Schirego, and overall technical supervision was by Wayne Mulligan. This is Dick Bertel speaking. Good night, everybody.